billionaires convened by the Koch brothers to fund a plutocratic takeover of this year's congressional elections. McConnell was the featured act at the three-day Kochapalooza held at the posh St. Regis Monarch Bay Resort in Dana Point, and he titillated the elites with the changes that would result from a GOP takeover of the Senate. For one thing, he exulted, we're not going to be debating all those gosh darn proposals. Like what, you ask? Like raising the minimum wage, explained the senator from Kentucky, a state with tens of thousands of minimum wage workers desperately needing a raise. Poor Mitch, for once he was being honest, thinking his candor would not be heard outside this closed-door enclave of cokeheads. But oops, a recording was leaked to the Nation magazine, and now the voters of Kentucky are learning how put upon their nearly $200,000-a-year senator feels for just having to talk about those gosh-darn proposals to lift the roughly $15,000-a-year poverty pay of his minimum-wage constituents. This is Jim Hightower saying, keep talking, Mitch. Such stuff is what makes politics the greatest show on earth. Or is it the funniest or saddest? You choose.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Join KGNU starting Monday, September 8th for a week-long look at the one-year anniversary of the historic 2013 floods.
Okay, this is the sound of the South St. Vrain River, which has, it looks like the Congo at this moment.
We are in Longmont, Colorado at Lincoln in the flood, first in Lincoln. And it is something, it's a river out here.
We'll have updates every day on the Morning Magazine, checking in with some of the worst affected areas. And our coverage culminates on Friday, September 12th, on Connections with a panel discussion on the flood recovery. That's a week looking at the one-year anniversary of the historic floods here at KGNU.
And you can have a listen to some of the coverage that we've already had this week at news.kgnu.org. This morning, we turn to Lyons, one of the towns most impacted by the flood. Here is a radio documentary produced right here at KGNU after the flood. In the early hours of September 12th, 2013, residents of Lyons were awakened from their sleep by sirens and warnings to move to higher ground. The St. Vrain River had burst its banks and the town was flooding.
We got a knock on the door from a neighbor that said they were being evacuated just directly across the street. And right behind them is a big trailer park and then the river. And the river had actually already come up into the trailer park and was, I could actually hear the river on our street.
Bonnie Sue Hitchcock and her family lived in what came to be known as the Confluence area of Lyons, a low-lying neighbourhood close to where the North and South St. Vrain rivers merge. In those early hours, as the waters were rising, residents scrambled to grab belongings and head to higher ground. Bonnie Sue Hitchcock is a writer who took her recording equipment with her when she and her family headed to her friend Alison Jennings' house, just up the hill. Over the next several days of the Lyons flood, she recorded conversations with her fellow stranded residents.
When I looked for her email on my phone because my internet is down. I wanted to text or email her and say...
They took us in, and the next day took in a couple more people that had been evacuated as well. Just for the record, you have been housing someone in your house for 24 hours.
Yes.
That you thought you'd never met. You didn't have any...
Yes.
This is a neighbor...
Well, I met this woman on the street yesterday, and her name was Lori, and she needed a place to stay last night, so she came to my house, and I've even told people, well, I have someone at my house that I don't know, that I've never met before, and then I find out today that her daughter-in-law is one of my favorite people on the entire planet. And I really do know her. Yeah, just that you realize that you have connections with all these people, and you don't realize it until something like this happens. And you're the circle of connections, perfect. And you're, well, you're forced out of what you do every day, and you meet amazing people.
By Thursday morning, the full extent of the damage became apparent to the evacuees up at Allison's house.
How was it, Lori? Lori's back from looking at her house.
Oh, it was 2 feet of mud, and unusual things were on the walls still, and I had a lamp that was sitting out on the porch, and the table moved and everything, and it was still standing up straight, and a little cast iron fairy was still sitting there.
Wow.
That was amazing.
It looked like
the lamp was sitting up straight, and it was a big, tall lamp.
Wow.
And I found some of my Estee Lauder cream that I liked.
So, now, how many years have you lived in your house?
Let me see, 35 years.
And you never saw anything like this
before?
Never.
Bathroom sink was full of mud, this big, full. And
that looks like about 4 feet.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't all the way up to the sink. It just came in and filled up the sink, and then the floor was this high, probably 2 feet, maybe more. It was awful.
Okay, this is the sound of the South St. Vrain River, which has, it looks like the Congo at this moment, and has completely risen and taken out a trailer court that, I don't know how many trailers were in this trailer park, but they're all moved. Many of them are gone. Oh, there's an old cabin that is completely underwater. You can just see the roof. And some cars underwater. This was a trail that went to Bone Park in Lyons, and it's completely gone. Does anybody want to jump in here and describe this? Can you describe this?
The river is, it's running where there wasn't a river before.
This was just a bike trail. It's completely gone.
It's now 100 yards wide and brown with trees going downstream at 12 knots.
Okay. So down the path, there used to be a whole forest on the right-hand side of the tree going over towards the river, but now that forest is all gone. The levee was on the left-hand side. The levee's obviously broken, and it's totally flooded into the trailer park area. It's absolutely amazing.
The river had taken out all the bridges in the town, and Bonnie Sue and the other evacuees at Allison's house started to realize that they were, for all intents and purposes, marooned.
Yeah. I mean, that's incredible. There's so many homes up there. So there are 6 islands divided by the floodwaters, and there's no communication between the islands. So we really don't know how people are doing.
Are we Island 3, or...?
I call us Twiggly Island. People say, where do you live? And I say, Twiggly Island.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I say.
Miss Twiggly's Tree is a children's picture book. In the story, Miss Twiggly's treehouse becomes a refuge for the whole town after a flood. Up on Lyons Twiggly Island, spirits were high.
So Kevin Parker had the meeting downtown this morning, and Victoria Simonson, who's the town administrator. Mm-hmm. And Kevin used to be our substation chief, or he was the head guy, but he has since moved on, but he's wonderful. I thought they had a great meeting. They were organized. But what was amazing is people were kind of getting all booty hurt that they didn't have a bullhorn. but they just don't have access to that. So they just yelled to this enormous crowd of several hundred people, just telling them what the instructions were going to be. It was well thought out. It was planful. And they were very reassuring that we're going to come back from this.
Town administrator Victoria Simonson and other town officials held meetings on the different islands that had been created in Lyons, trying to get information to the stranded residents.
When we still had communication, I tried to set up a little team on each island, one made of a leader, one made of a communications person and a medical person. And we did our best to communicate with those people. Actually, they would actually hike over the mountain to get to the other island to find out what was going on. And we held meetings on each island. I actually accessed those by going four-wheeling through water to get to them and update them on what we were trying to do to help them on the other side.
They really just encouraged everyone to go home and stay as dry as possible today. And then tomorrow morning there's another meeting, and they will tell people if you can evacuate yourself. But if you choose to leave, you cannot come back. And it could be weeks.
How was your day, sir?
With no power and no water in the town, those who decided to stay shared resources. The town had a party-like atmosphere with people emptying their freezers and grilling steaks. Restaurants and stores opened their refrigerators and shelves and shared their wares. And neighbors shared stories of the flood.
Well, we woke up when the sirens went off, and this was Wednesday night, and so we sat up in bed and realized that we didn't know where to go for information. And so we opened the computer, and first thing that came to mind was the Boulder County Sheriff. So we typed in Boulder County Sheriff to Google and went to their website, and the first thing that comes up, the headline on the Boulder County Sheriff's page, was the fire ban was rescinded.
It's almost as if we thought we were all just on our little island having a big party. We did have a big street barbecue. Everybody was in great spirits. We had so much food because a lot of people had perishable items that they wanted to, you know, someone next door had half a cow. We were eating filet mignon. And, you know, it's shocking to think that it was just this wonderful, fun time, and then the next day we were told, you've got to get out of here.
By Saturday morning, officials announced that everyone in the flood-ravaged town of Lyons had to leave.
So this morning at 9 o'clock, they did an emergency briefing for the whole town, and you know, FEMA was there, and they basically then said, we need everyone to go. The water treatment plant was gone. We have no water, we have no power. And power lines are down, gas leaks everywhere. You know, it's starting, like, having people in town was just making it hard for emergency people to do their work. So they, you know, basically they said, we need you to go. I think it was the first time that we all looked at each other and really, really felt this devastation of, like, we have to leave this. It was a huge realization of how bad things were, and that we probably can't go back for quite a while.
You are listening to After the Flood, a KGNU radio documentary. I'm Maeve Conran.
Thank you.
It's been a year since the St. Vrain River burst its banks and damaged more than 210 homes in Lyons, many completely destroyed and many others deemed uninhabitable. Most residents returned several weeks after the initial evacuation, but many others are still displaced.
Somebody better be laying in the box, otherwise.
Bonnie Sue Hitchcock's chickens have returned to live in their coop behind her former house. Some of the garden is back. The grapevine is thriving. But she and her family, like many of her neighbours in the confluence, are still displaced. Bonnie Sue's house is now being rebuilt. It's several feet higher than the 100-year-old house that stood there before. Elevating the house was the only way they could get a rebuilding permit. But that process was by no means easy.
There were steps down to it, which was kind of odd. So it'll be the same. And then this is just going to be like a little kind of hangout room.
Delays in getting insurance money, delays in getting the multitude of required building permits has meant that 1 year after the flood, she and her family are nowhere close to moving home.
So we're sitting outside this really tall house that used to be a really small house. And we're coming up on the 1 year anniversary of the flood. And, you know, we're really fortunate if you walk around our neighborhood. We're really much farther along in the process than a lot of people are right now. It's been a really long process.
It's been a long road home for Bonnie Sue and her neighbours. Most have not returned. Many have not yet begun the rebuilding process. An air of uncertainty hangs over this neighbourhood as the town considers a new flood plan and what that may mean for local homes.
Being in limbo is just too hard for people, and you're paying mortgage and you're paying rent, and, you know, over time you just start to feel like you're not really living your life, you're just reacting to it.
It's unclear when or if this part of Lyons will ever fully recover from the flood. Some of the residents are considering a FEMA buyout of their property. Others are trying to rebuild, but are caught in a bureaucratic web of permit applications and insurance claims.
The reality is it just isn't that cut and dry. You know, and we've spent, you know, everyone in this neighborhood has been going to meetings every week for an entire year. And I know the whole town of Lyons had meeting fatigue, you know, a long time ago. So, I mean, yes, there are some options for people, but, it's a really big process to jump through all those hoops and meet with all those people. And, if you walk around the neighborhood, the people that are the farthest along, you know, are retired because this is a full-time job.
This neighborhood was home to artists, musicians, a mobile home park, young and old, new and longtime residents of Lyons. Walking around on this Labor Day weekend, a quiet hangs over the houses, some which still bear the orange X on the door, FEMA's mark that it's uninhabitable. It's been a year since the St. Vrain crested its bank in Lyons. For some, it's been a year of recovery. For others, a year of uncertainty.
I mean, honestly, quite honestly, I just want all these people back, you know, and that's what I want. And I don't think I'll ever really feel great about the outcome. I mean, I just want people to have what they wanted, you know. You want to have the life you chose. I mean, they chose to buy these houses and live in this neighborhood for a reason.
After the flood, on KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran. You can see photos from Lyons, including Bonnie Sue Hitchcock's home before and after the flood. It's all at our website, news.kgnu.org. And music in that documentary was by the Water Girls. That was a group that was formed by Lyons musicians in the aftermath of the flood. And since the flood in the last 12 months, there has been a lot of music written about that event, including this song, Forward On, a song written out of the flood of September 12th, 2013, dedicated to the communities of Lyons and Jamestown by Tim Cook and the Big Medicine Gang. Don, Tim Cook and Big Medicine Gang. One of the many songs written about last year's flood as we are now at our 1 year mark. And here at KGNU, we've been doing a week of coverage looking at the recovery process and what that looks like. You can find out more and listen again to stories and see some of those photos at news.kgnu.org. Tomorrow morning on The Morning Magazine, we'll hear a report on how some of the small businesses in Lyons are recovering in the aftermath of the flood. Where are they? 12 months out. And at 8:30 tomorrow morning, join host Liz Lane on Connections for a panel discussion on the recovery process. Gary Sanfason, who is Boulder County Flood Recovery Manager, will be one of the guests, along with Stephanie Walton, who is the Long-Term Flood Recovery Group Executive Director. And it will be a call-in show, so please do call in and let us know your thoughts. Where are we 1 year out after the flood? It's 8:59. This is Community Radio KGNU Boulder, Denver. Just some announcements. Coming up on Monday's Metro, host Miriam Schiff takes a look at Be Safe Neighbourhoods in Boulder and the expansion of those neighbourhoods. And there are some events happening this weekend if you are interested in the Be Safe movement. On Sunday, there's going to be a potluck gathering from 4 to 7 put on by Be Safe Boulder. You can find out more at besafeboulder.com. It's happening
happening on Conifer Court in North Boulder. If you're interested in creating a Be Safe neighbourhood, or you're already part of one, you can find out more at that potluck. It's happening on Sunday. BeSafeBoulder.com is the information where you can get that. Saturday the 13th, this coming Saturday, the City of Boulder is sponsoring a walkabout from 10 till 12 at the Melody Catalpa Boulder neighbourhood, which is the first Be Safe neighbourhood in North Boulder. There'll actually be a bluegrass band for entertainment. It's a big community gathering, and it all starts from 10 to 12. It starts at the Pineview Park, which is at the south end of Catalpa Drive in North Boulder. It's 9 o'clock. You're listening to Community Radio, KGNU Boulder, Denver. We turn next to how can communities be more resilient and how can they come back after a natural disaster. Many people have looked to Katrina as a community that was also impacted, albeit in a very different way. It's been 9 years since Hurricane Katrina pummeled New Orleans, and while events there and events in Colorado are very different, people are looking to what happened, particularly in the recovery process and how the displaced population returned. I spoke with Charles Chamberlain. He lives in New Orleans, but he has deep Colorado connections. His family have been coming to Estes Park for decades, and he's been to Estes Park and Lyons since the flood. He's made observations about the differences and sometimes similarities between the two events. And I asked him about how those who've been displaced in New Orleans, whether or not they've returned.
The number of households receiving mail is almost up to what it was in August 2005. But you still hear stories about people, I know even a few people myself, who just have not come back. And it's kind of an interesting mix, because some people came back when they could immediately because they just did not like where they live. The lifestyle here is so distinct that, say, when you live in Atlanta or Houston and they don't have a Mardi Gras and they don't cook the same way and they don't have the same kind of joie de vivre we have down here, that they miss that. So they came back regardless of whether their house was ready to live in or whether their job was back or anything, any number of things, even their kids' school. But then you have other people who claim they found a better quality of life elsewhere. They found better jobs, better pay, better schools, better neighborhoods, and so they don't want to move back. So I think there are some people who would still like to come back, but they can't for whatever reason. And then you also have this phenomenon, which I think is hitting every American city, where in general, the center part of the city, the older parts of the city, the property values are rising. So rents are increasing, and so people who have a lower income find it harder to live in the center of the city, and they're being pushed out to the poorer suburbs. And so certainly you find that in New Orleans, where a lot of the people who wanted to come back then were forced to live in apartments in one of the outlying suburbs, and they feel like they're stuck out there. And so, you know, now they have to drive into the city for their job. They resent that. A lot of the old institutions and the neighborhood fabric that they knew from pre-Katrina is gone. And so a lot of that is different. And I would say, in terms of kind of attitudes based on race and ethnicity, what you find is, you know, a lot of white people say that the city is better now. Like, for example, crime is lower, schools are better, that you have an influx of energetic, educated white entrepreneurs, you know, young white entrepreneurs who want to live in New Orleans because it's so unique. And then you also have more of an international mix of people, because after the storm you had a huge influx of Hispanic workers come in that wasn't present before the storm. Meanwhile, a lot of African Americans claim that their old quality of life, the fabric of their neighborhood, a lot of their neighborhood institutions are gone and will never come back, and so they feel resentful. And especially in terms of the school system, a lot of, say, older black teachers who were fired immediately after the storm and then never rehired. Meanwhile, Teach for America has come in and hired a lot of young white, you know, Ivy League or liberal arts college teachers, and they feel like they are not valued for their experience, and they feel bitter about that. So, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag in terms of opinion on whether the storm has done good or not. Overall, I'd say in terms of the school system, that the school system before the storm was very dysfunctional, and a lot of schools performed poorly. The charter system, the test scores have generally risen. Quality's improved, but what it means is that there's no more neighborhood-based schools, and so people have to drive, you know, 10 miles to go to a school now when before they could just walk around the corner to their neighborhood school. And so that's created a huge stress on people who are working and then have to take, you know, two different kids to two different schools in different parts of the city. Again, kind of a mixed bag.
That's Charles Chamberlain. He lives in New Orleans. He has deep Colorado connections. Speaking there about what's happened to New Orleans, particularly for that displaced population 9 years after Hurricane Katrina pummeled that city. Now, why what happened in New Orleans is quite different to what happened in Colorado, there are many similarities. And researchers are looking to other communities that have been impacted by natural disasters to inform what might happen here in the recovery process 1 year after the flood. I spoke with Desiree Anderson Crow. She's the Associate Director at the Center for Environmental Journalism. She's doing studies into Boulder County, Larimer and Weld counties in their recovery process to see what those communities are doing. I also spoke with Jennifer Dinger, who's a doctoral candidate in management and entrepreneurship at the Leeds School of Business. She's been doing research into the economic resilience of communities following natural disasters.
So my research in this space really began, I was home visiting after my first year of my doctoral program in Joplin, Missouri for my brother's wedding when the F5 tornado hit in the spring of 2011. And so I ended up staying throughout the summer and I witnessed small business owners vowing to rebuild and making this commitment almost immediately after the disaster, despite the fact that there was a 4 mile radius where there was essentially nothing. So there were no customers, there wasn't the infrastructure, and I just got a sense of this commitment to the community and almost an irrationality with regards to financial decisions. And so that was the first study. And what we found is that people will forego their own economic benefit for the sake of the community initially. And that's really driven by the attractiveness of the community and the interdependency belief. And but unfortunately, we've learned from other disasters, specifically earthquakes and hurricanes, that this initial influx in business activity tapers off after a 3 to 4 year period. And so my concern is really for the longevity and the viability long term for communities like Lyons and Jamestown.
Have you been able to look at those communities specifically with regard to the flood and the impact on small businesses?
So I haven't collected all of the data just because it only has been 1 year and typically it's the 3 to 4 year period. But, you know, despite the fact that you know, these are smaller communities, it is actually very similar to the larger cities such as Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans and the Northridge quake in California. So I expect there to be this initial boom, but as you said, the gentrification, these small businesses, the ability of housing and the ability of employment are the two main drivers. And it typically takes, from the research that I've seen and conducted, it typically takes 10 years for a population to return to pre-disaster levels. So this isn't going to be something that occurs just in the first year or two. It's going to be a very long process.
And of course, then the ability for small businesses to recover is so connected with the ability of the town's population to recover, because that's the business. I mean, they are the customers in many ways.
They're so interrelated. They're so dependent on one another. And that's where my research, I'm really diving into that individual decision making rather than the macroeconomic trends. So they're making this decision to rebuild almost immediately because of their emotional ties to the community. And we're trying to dig deep and understand, are they truly evaluating what the business opportunity is in the future instead of just replicating and doing what they'd always done before? And again, this gets back to the viability long term of the business because, you know, small business failure rates, we know in Boulder, are high in general. But communities that suffer these disasters, they experience failure rate at a higher rate. So I'm hoping to understand those initial decision-making processes so that policymakers, city governments, Chamber of Commerce can possibly interject into that process and the rebuilding process. And so at this point, it's all about learning from the Jamestowns and the Lyons so that we can help future communities.
Can you learn from anything from other communities, like you mentioned Joplin, Missouri, and some other communities that have suffered natural disasters? Is there anything that can be learned that maybe those policymakers and community leaders can implement right now in the rebuilding process?
Yeah, you know, every disaster is different. Joplin received a tremendous amount of media coverage, national media coverage, presidential visits. And so it's important to keep the attention and the spirit going so that the community members and specifically the business owners feel support. But then again, it's, you know, that always that feeling of supporting local business is key. And they should be able to enjoy that spike and support for the next few years.
And in Lyons, of course, now we're at the 1 year commemoration, not just Lyons, of course, the entire Front Range that experienced mm-hmm. the flooding. A lot of events happening to keep that kind of front and center.
Right.
But what typically is the pattern in terms of when that starts to fade for the wider population in terms of attention?
Well, it depends on the news cycle. And Joplin was lucky that it fell in a period where there wasn't a lot of other things happening. For Longmont and Lyons, it's, of course, been the focus consistently throughout the year here locally. I would say, though, the national coverage dropped off quite quickly as other things occurred in the news cycle. We saw this with Hurricane or Superstorm Sandy. It was a horrific event across a huge swath of the Northeast coast, but because it fell so close to the elections, the attention was kind of cut off. And so it'll be interesting to see long term how that attention impacts it.
And is that national focus, is that important, or is it really just about as long as people locally are aware that this is still a community in recovery and still needs support?
So I haven't teased apart those differences of the local versus national coverage. That's not really what I do. Anecdotally, it appears that the national coverage is important for generating that spirit and the sense that it's important. And people in Joplin specifically are still citing the attention that they received. President Obama is going to be attending the high school's reopening that they are rebuilding and reopening this month, actually. And so I think it's important to get that coverage still. And I expect that we'll receive some of that this week, as people remember, especially with the Weather Channel and other national news coverage.
Well, Desiree, let's talk about your work and mm-hmm. and what has been your experience? Have you looked at other communities that have experienced natural disasters that might in any way inform community leaders, policymakers now in the recovery process here?
Well, there's a fair amount of work that's been done on other communities, and our focus is we're comparing the communities in the three hardest hit counties in Colorado, Boulder, Larimer, and Weld County, and trying to understand their processes and their decisions going forward that are either more or less likely to help them lead to a more resilient community in the aftermath of that destruction. And to piggyback on something that was just said, I think that another reason why the national coverage is important to continue and to generate that spirit and so forth also goes to resources, because so many of the resources, for example, in Lyons, this is a town with something in the order of $1 million town budget and only 17 permanent staff members before the flood, and they had tens of millions of dollars of damage. So they're relying to a great extent on FEMA and other external sources. So as attention shifts away, the state of Colorado and local governments certainly are still paying attention, but those external resources are really critical for towns that are faced with such destruction that it really goes beyond their capacity to deal with. So those are some of the things that we're looking at. And for your question regarding gentrification, I think that really goes to some of the processes and some of the considerations communities are dealing with now. So I'd be happy to chat a bit more about that, but I think that these communities, we're seeing a lot of different approaches that they're taking to their recovery and rebuilding process, and I think that that's going to be important in predicting what we see in the long term.
Well, we'll talk about gentrification in just a moment, but I would like to touch on something that Jennifer Dinger, you said that it often takes about 10 years for a community to return to the pre-disaster population. Is that a fair assessment? Well, what does that 10-year recovery process look like? Is that often the same people who were all displaced, who it's taken them 10 years to come back? Or is there a portion of the community who will never return for a variety of different reasons? And so the people who are coming back 10 years afterwards, it's a very different community afterwards.
Right. And there is no guarantee that the people who exit will return. And we saw it with Hurricane Katrina in Joplin. About 30% of the population migrated to other areas regionally. It's hard to say in terms of tracking individuals specifically. It definitely is new people coming into the community, but that's why small business is so critical, because small business is tied to larger unemployment rates, innovation, knowledge transfer, just general human capital levels. And so that's why small business is such a key. And while the population recovers, the economies typically never recover fully. They usually settle at 90% of the pre-disaster levels, and that's where they stay. But in communities where the small business comes back stronger, they're closer to the pre-disaster levels. So while it's fabulous for the big box stores and the corporations to return, and it's typically easier for them because of the capital that they have, that's why it's really important for small business to receive not only the federal funding, like Desiree mentioned, but also support from the community.
Well, Desiree, what are your thoughts on that, about what a post-disaster community looks like compared to the pre-disaster? When you have maybe, if we look at the pure numbers, maybe the population numbers might return to the pre-disaster level maybe 10 years after a disaster. But if you look at actually who is in that community, it can often be quite a different makeup.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a couple of things are important to note in that quick rebuilding happens in part because of FEMA requirements in terms of timelines and type of rebuilding that happens. And so some communities are really having to push to rebuild differently, to rebuild better, to not just have to put things back the way they were and therefore be in a high-risk situation again. So that also has to do with some of the timeline. In terms of who makes up these communities, it's a really important question going forward, because we see in Estes Park, for example, they don't get a lot of attention, but there was a large immigrant community that worked in a lot of the service sector in Estes Park. In Evans, their hardest-hit area of the community was a low-income trailer park that housed a lot of undocumented immigrants. So this is beyond just Lyons and certainly Jamestown. A lot of communities are seeing these same things where their most vulnerable residents are the ones hardest hit. However, in some communities, you see a lot more awareness and acknowledgement. For example, in Lyons, town officials clearly state that part of the reason people live in Lyons and perhaps not Boulder or another area is because they love that diversity of income levels, of artists and professionals and people who work in the service sector. So they want to maintain that character. And I think the awareness by government officials and also the inclusion of the public in rebuilding and recovery processes going forward is why you can't make it go back the way it was in terms of the demographics of people. It's the best approach we have for probably encouraging that. So, for example, in Lyons, they have an incredibly inclusive process, which a lot of people are studying, just their process of how they're having all of their residents sign up for various task forces to work on deliberative processes about what's their housing going to look like, what are parks and recreation areas going to look like, and roads and bridges and their historical spaces and assets. And so that's a process where I think they're giving themselves the best chance to recover and to bring back that kind of inclusive and diverse community. And we're not seeing that across all communities. So I think that there will be lessons to learn in terms of that and what kind of best practices are for encouraging that long-term recovery and diversity of residents.
That's Desiree Anderson Crowe. She's the Associate Director at the Center for Environmental Journalism at CU Boulder. She's one of my guests, along with Jennifer Dinger, who's a doctoral candidate in Management and Entrepreneurship at the Leeds School of Business. And we're talking this morning on KGNU as we are at the 1 year commemoration of the historic floods of last year, talking about what it means for communities to fully recover, maybe comparing to what's happened in other communities around the country that have suffered natural disasters. What does it mean for a community that relies on small businesses that does not have big box stores, for example, Lyons? And what does it mean for communities that have lost so many of the low income and affordable housing, like we've seen in communities like Evans and Longmont, where entire mobile home parks have been wiped out and will never be rebuilt again? You're listening to Community Radio KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran. And don't forget, you can go to our website, news.kgnu.org, to see all of our coverage that we've had this week of the 1 year mark post flood, but also some of the coverage that we did in the early days of the flood a year ago. Well, Desiree, you cited there the process of what's happening in Lyons, where it's a very conscious thing. People are very aware of the people that have been displaced, and there's a real conscious effort to recreate that community, to bring those people home. Despite that consciousness, are there other factors at play that could really just make it inevitable that a certain part of the community will never return? Because, I mean, if you've had to move away and then you've maybe had to find employment from where you've lived because it's now not possible to do that commute, maybe your kids have had to go to a new school and you've lost that connection with your neighbours, that sometimes those are just insurmountable despite the best efforts and the best intentions of the community.
Yes, I think that that's exactly right. And I think that's something that community leaders need to guard against. In Lyons, for example, they, for a number of months after the disaster, held weekly and then monthly community meetings in Longmont, because not only were, for 2 months, was their own community not habitable, but additionally, most of the people who were displaced, in especially in rental housing and so forth, had moved to Longmont. And so it allowed people to be involved in town meetings who might not otherwise be. But I think that really is, it's a reality. I don't think there's anything that community leaders can do to completely guard against that risk. However, I think there needs to be some level of awareness of deliberately bringing those people, soliciting their input, and also providing them with assistance in moving back to the community if that's really a valued asset. Like Jenny was talking about, these small businesses are such an important asset to communities, and certainly the local population is their customer base, but the local population is often also their employee base. So it's really this interconnected problem where if you don't have a lot of these people who may be lower income, who may bring that diversity to a community, you may also have trouble keeping your businesses local because they're going to have a hard time finding people to work in the service sector. I know Estes Park is wrestling with this. I expect that Lyons will be too. And so this is something that community leaders need to be aware of and be working with their business community, certainly with their housing planning task forces or boards, in order to make sure that those people don't just disappear from the community.
With Jennifer Dinger, you've been looking at the economic resilience of communities following natural disasters and what role small businesses play in that. When we translate that economic resilience into maybe social resilience as well, what role do small businesses and their recovery play in the resilience then of the community and that social fabric that we see? I mean, for example, you know, being able to walk to your local coffee shop and meet with your neighbours, or to get your prescription filled at the local pharmacy as opposed to having to drive somewhere. I mean, it's not just an economic benefit to have the small businesses back, but it would seem that there are other social benefits too that are also as important to the recovery process.
Right. There were also a string of storms this spring in late April, some tornadoes that hit Baxter Springs, Kansas, Valonia, Arkansas, and Mayflower, Arkansas, that were pretty devastating to those communities. And I've been conducting interviews repeatedly with the business owners, and they have said time and time again that they received calls the night of the storm, before they had even seen it in daylight, from their customers expressing how important it was for them to return. And most of these people have seen bumps in their business since rebuilding or restarting. And so they're continuously getting feedback of how important they are to be seen, and the customers express how it would have been very difficult to perhaps not have seen the Weston's Cafe that had been there for decades. If that hadn't returned, who knows how it would have impacted the neighboring businesses. But another point that I think is so important is, you know, these billion-dollar disasters are occurring. The U.S. often sees more than 10 per year, $10 billion disasters. And because of the frequency of those now, we're seeing support from communities. So there are social ventures in Joplin that then helped in Moore, Oklahoma, which then we saw them out here last fall helping to spread. So I think now as a community, we Coloradans who suffered the flood, we have a responsibility to then go and teach the next communities and help them through, especially with this issue of losing the population, because the people that migrate, like as Desiree was saying, that's going to be critical for the long-term viability. If that employee base isn't there, the businesses are going to suffer. And so I think especially Lyons, because it is unique in that it is a smaller community, but they did have a vibrant downtown, and it is coming back, that we have a responsibility to then share that.
And then, of course, beyond that economic benefit of having that employee base, of course, just to have your neighbours back and a diverse community as opposed to a more affluent community and the people who could afford to move back.
Absolutely.
Well, Desiree, is it too early in the process, 1 year after the floods, to really have an idea of how towns are recovering, given that, you know, I've heard not just from Jennifer and yourself, but this 10-year mark as really being that kind of benchmark for not just full recovery, but a real noticeable recovery after a natural disaster?
Yeah, I think it is too early to some extent because, for example, the final community, Lyons, didn't even move from the emergency response to recovery phase and rebuilding phase of this process until the middle of December, when all of their members, their community members, were back in the town who could be, and when basic utilities were restored. So we haven't had a full year of the recovery and rebuilding yet. And I've heard by some estimates that the actual recovery and rebuilding doesn't really start in some communities until a year after the disaster, simply because there is so much emotional and physical and infrastructure drama and trauma. And because there is, quite frankly, a lot of paperwork and hoops to jump through for reimbursement processes and so forth. And so communities spent probably most of the first half of this year just trying to figure out what they were going to do and how they were going to get the funds to do that. And in many cases are either kind of patched things back together temporarily or are only now starting on some of the long-term rebuilding and recovery. So, but at the same time, I do think that we can start to see these processes, like that very inclusive, deliberative process in Lyons, for example, that we don't know that what the end result will be, but we can see that they're setting themselves up for a more successful recovery than they otherwise might. We don't know what it will look like in a few years, but so far it appears that they're doing the right things to hopefully give themselves a fighting chance.
And I completely agree with what Desiree said. I think it's great that they are taking that very deliberate process and that they've waited to take some action, because the first several months are about surviving, and now it's getting a level set of what the new norm is for Lyons, Colorado. So.
And I recently took a walk in one of the most hardest hit areas, the Confluence area downtown. A lot of older homes there. There was the mobile home, one of the mobile home parks was there. And it was eerily quiet. And this was on Labor Day, when you would imagine a lot of people would be home having barbecues. Just a handful of people who are either back or in the process of rebuilding. And I know that there have been many barriers and for a whole variety of reasons. And what else can be done beyond the awareness and the process that is really looking towards inclusion? Is there anything that can happen at a state level, at a federal level, that could speed the process along, if that's even possible, so that people can be brought back to their communities?
From my perspective, I agree this has been devastating. I grew up in Longmont, and my dad spent most of his later years in and around Lyons for about 30 years. So the first time I drove through last December, I I was very emotional seeing the destruction in such a special place. I think that so much of it, when we see success stories, the resources from outside are incredibly important, especially for a town that has such limited capacity like Lyons. However, I think that their chances of recovery have more to do with what's going on inside that community, and as Jenny termed it, kind of the spirit of the community. And I'm on Lyons's listserv, and they send out daily updates. They're really fantastic at communication to the public, and they are really doing an excellent job of keeping that spirit of kind of championing the idea of their community and the idea of recovery and of togetherness. And I don't know if that will last, but certainly so far, that internal ability, despite such limited resources, has really been amazing for me to watch. And I think other communities could take a lesson from what Lyons is doing. Perhaps Lyons was forced into it because they're such a small town, but whoever's coming up with these ideas in their town government or around their town government, it seems to be what needs to happen, because some of that can only happen from inside a community.
Jennifer, do you have any final thoughts?
No, I'm really excited to see what's happened in Lyons. I haven't been up to the Jamestown area yet, but I think, you know, what Desiree said in terms of the spirit of the community, the social identity, if they can maintain that, that's going to be critical for the long-term viability.
Jennifer Dinger is a doctoral candidate in management and entrepreneurship at the Leeds School of Business at CU Boulder, and she has been studying the economic resilience of communities following natural disasters. And Desiree Anderson Crowe is the Assistant Professor in Environmental Studies Program and the Associate Director of the Centre for Environmental Journalism at CU Boulder. And she's doing some research into three of the counties hardest hit by last year's flood, Boulder, Larimer and Weld County, looking at their recovery process. Desiree and Jennifer, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And you can find out more, as I said, of our ongoing coverage of the flood and the 1 year commemoration, the 1 year anniversary of the flood, as well as some of our flood coverage from the early days of the flood. It's all at news.kgnu.org. And tomorrow morning on Connections, Friday at 8:30, Liz Lane hosts a panel discussion looking at some of the nuts and bolts of the recovery process. This is Community Radio, KGNU. And do join us for Connections tomorrow. It'll be your opportunity to call in and tell us your thoughts on this 1 year mark post-flood. That's Connections tomorrow at 8:30. Due to the colder temperatures today, highs today just around 50 degrees and overnight lows today in the mid to low 30s. That's the forecast. There will be an emergency warming centre this evening at Pine Street Church, which is 1237 Pine Street in Boulder. You're asked not to use the entrance on the east side of the building off 13th Street. Please do use that entrance on the east side of the building off 13th Street, but don't arrive earlier than 6 p.m. The doors will open at 7. That's an emergency warming centre this evening at Pine Street Church in downtown Boulder. It's 9:32. Stay tuned for the Morning Sound Alternative.